Strategic Christian Services is pleased to present Teamwork to Revive Marriage by Jeff Kemp.
When you think about a legacy, you wonder how you will be remembered looking back on your life. I retired from football, and that was kind of a first life for me. I'm now in the second life. That was a fun life, but it ends pretty quickly. You have to retire at age 32 or 3, and that was a long career. But as I was wondering, how I might be remembered after those years as a free agent, struggling backup who occasionally got the start and have a couple bright years with Jerry Rice and Steve Largent and guys like that, I found out how I would be remembered. Walking out of church one day, a 12-year-old kid named Spencer, walking along next to me in the parking lot, a friend of my son Kyle's. Kyle now works in New York City. He's 26 now. But back when they were 12, Spencer says, "Hey, Mr. Kemp, you should hear the funny thing that happened in church today." I was like, "What?" He goes, "Well, Kyle was in class," and I knew this story had to have something to do with Kyle because this is his personality. And she says, "The teacher was talking to us about using our words to build up, to be positive, to encourage, not to tear down and be negative, and how important that is." And she asked for a volunteer, and Kyle raised his hand. She said, "Kyle, what do you really love to do?" And Kyle said, "Play football." And she said, "Okay, that's what I thought you'd say. So imagine this. Imagine you're playing a game of football, and you're really trying hard, putting everything you have into it. But it's really not going that well. And worse than that, people are saying really mean, negative things about you. What if people were criticizing you, making fun of you? What if everyone was booing you? How would that make you feel?" And Kyle said, "Like my dad." Yeah, I was thrilled to see the kids got a sense of humor, but a little bit upset at the object of that darn humor. I have a lot of these types of experiences in my family. Another one ties into the marriage theme, which I'll be speaking about, passing on a legacy of the blueprints of marriage to a culture that's been missing them and has so many counterfeits that I think it's ripe for the authentic and the real. And I don't think we should make this a secondary or tertiary issue. I think this ought to be a front and center key part of our cultural reformation effort, our evangelistic effort, our personal commitment, because it matters so much to us. And, of course, it matters to God's kingdom. He says, "Let marriage be honored among all." So here's how this works in the Kemp family. We think family dinner is really important. My mom and dad set that pace. Dad would come home from Congress at 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. Mom would have dinner on the table. The kids would have waited until Dad got home, and we'd all have family dinner every night. And he'd bring home a congressman or Gerald Ford or Gene Kirkpatrick from the UN, say things to Gene like, "Gene, could you explain detente to Jeff? You know, Jeff is 12. But that led to some great conversations, and Dad brought us into the adult world in that way. It was worldview every day at our house, just naturally. My wife is a master at this. She uses the newspaper, and she knows that my boys are more interested in the sports page than the front page. So she brings up news stories about athletes, and then she weaves back, what's the biblical principle of the character of this person or how that team's going? And it's fun for me because I can get into the conversation, but they tend to listen to her a lot more than me. Something is funny in my family. Four boys, I think they all want to prove their manhood, and so they don't really want to have to listen to Dad as much. But we had a great dinner conversation going one night years ago, and there were two of us. Two of them were off to college, two kids in the home, so that's four at the table. Keegan was about 13 or something like that, maybe less than that, maybe 10 or 11. And he got up from the table and was playing with Legos in the family room right next to the table. Colby's still at the table, and we're having this continuing post-dinner conversation. And my wife, Stacy, is talking about a woman at school, the mother of friends of my kids, who has amazing brunette hair and this beautiful set of blue eyes. And she was just remarking how she'd seen her today and was amazed at how beautiful her eyes were. This isn't a normal conversation you have with boys at the table, but for some reason, this is what was going on. And she must have been talking to me as well, and I was kind of giving it the absolute minimal male effort, the grunt, as if you're really there with her, but you're not really because you're thinking about something else. And actually, I was doing worse than thinking about something else. I had snuck the sports page from under the table and was kind of peeking at it while I was trying to pretend like I was, Mr. Family Values, dinner table conversation, togetherness. And so as she's talking about this woman in her eyes, I'm kind of grunting, just giving it a little grunt. And my son Keegan, about 10 feet away, playing with his Legos on the family room floor, he's got these relational radar that are awesome. And he gives me about 4 or 5 seconds to seize the marital moment as my wife tells me how beautiful this woman's eyes are. And then he says, "Dad, husband tip number one. Now would be a perfect time to say, oh, honey, your eyes are so much more beautiful than hers. From an 11-year-old. And my wife, bless her heart, has matured so much in the conformity to the character of Christ through the tough marriage she's faced with this guy that she was less frustrated that she's still got kind of a sluggo for a husband than she was encouraged that she's raising the next generation of great husbands. So, you know, the marriage movement doesn't happen right away. It kind of comes, sometimes takes a generation or so to kick in. But that's what we're doing in our family. I told you the story about the blitz. And then Lakita's message was a total embellishment of the blitz concept as she spoke about problems and the way they fit into God's context in a fallen world to draw us to Him, to help us be refined, to help us touch other lives, and to find new ways to bring God's presence into this world. It was a really cool talk that I enjoyed very much. And it seems like God must have planned these topics to be taught here at this conference because they fit together. And I want to tell a blitz story to start this morning off. Here's a blitz where it didn't turn around in the happy way that you'd like, certainly not quickly. And yet the blitz still had great value according to God's redeeming purposes to bless others and guide them to His hope and His truth and His love. A friend of mine named Dave Etter, I don't know if you've met him up in Seattle before, he's a very successful businessman. He's a part of a round table of about 50 Seattle business guys who meet weekly, and that's 52 weeks a year. There's time for each guy to share his life 1 week a year, and they kind of go in depth with one person. Now, it's not a Christian or spiritual group, it's a peer-to-peer business group. And they find it's a place to share their business life. And Dave told me that the group used to be kind of a personal aggrandizement club where you would talk about all the amazing deals you're making, how your business is going, and some of the tough decisions you have between whether you're going to make $10 million on this deal or $20 million on this deal. You know what I mean? They kind of got into a little bit of the self-congratulations. And one day a guy came in the group and he said, I am financially, morally, and personally bankrupt. My life is flatlined. He just put it out on the table. He couldn't spin anything. And as he did so and let his real self be seen, all of a sudden the depth of that group went to a whole new level. And each week the guys talking after that started to tell about the real things going on in their life, how difficult their business was, the trouble with their son on drugs, the pain that they were still experiencing because they couldn't overcome this particular problem. Wasn't it interesting that one man's vulnerability and transparency and flat-out honesty opened up the group to go to a different level? So Dave, I was married to a gal, Janice, for many years. They have a very strong and wonderful marriage. And Janice contracts brain cancer. And she passes away in a very short period of months. And he's devastated. And he is to come to the group about 2 months after her passing for the first time. He'd been gone for those 2 months. It's obvious that Dave, it's his turn to share, and it's obvious what he'll talk about if he can get it out. And he told me that he cried for about 70% of his hour and was able to speak for about 30% of that hour. But taking the great gift of his marriage and the incredible pain of losing his wife and the realization of where most of these guys are and how infrequently they really think about the most important things, their relationships and their marriages, he seized the moment. And he had gone to the store and bought 50 roses, 50 boxes of chocolates from Frango's, and 50 note cards that were blank, ready for men to write notes on. And he came into that group and he started telling his story and broke down in tears and telling more of his story and broke down in tears. And finally he finished. He said, I know a lot of you guys don't feel like your marriage is very good, like your wife doesn't really, you know, love or respect you all that much, and it may not have that much treasure to it, but I have to assure you that your wife is the greatest treasure in your whole life. And it's the degree to which you treat her like a treasure that she'll result in being a treasure, and you'll enjoy all the fruit in your marriage that you deserve. I had a wonderful marriage, and even if you don't have a wonderful marriage, she is your treasure, and I want to remind you of that. And so I bought these flowers and these chocolates and these cards for you to go home immediately after this meeting and write her a note. Tell her what she means to you. Let her know she's your treasure. And if you have to do anything other than go directly home and speak to her and give her the card, flowers, and chocolates, then you can come back here next week and you can tell us all what was more important to honor the relationship with the most important person in your life. This was on a Friday. On Saturday, Dave got a note in the mail. This is the most efficient performance of the U.S. Postal Service in history. Probably has something to do with the spiritual nature of what Dave ran and happened in this guy's life. God aided the Postal Service. He gets a note back a day later from a guy with a very successful public company and, you know, all the pieces looking good on the outside. And he says, Dave, thank you so much for sharing yesterday and for your gift challenging me to go and approach my wife and tell her I loved her. Because when I got home, her bags were packed and she was leaving me. And that cracked the ice, softened her enough that she said, yes, I'll stay and work on this. And I now know what I need to do. That couple, I checked with Dave a little while ago, they're still together and they're well. Dave Ederer took his blitz, his loss, and he turned it into a gain for others because his vision was bigger than himself. He didn't stay in his pity party. And you know he had pain. He didn't hide it from that group. But he converted it to giving others a vision that they could value the very thing that he had just lost. He now is remarried and has a wonderful marriage. But I think that is the absolute wonderful story of a friend of marriage. A marriage champion isn't someone with a perfect marriage. It's someone who champions marriage on behalf of others. He was honoring marriage before his group of 50. That was his sphere of influence. Every single one of you has something in your head that's going on right now that you're wondering, what's my sphere of influence? What about that person that I need to invite to lunch, that I need to take out for a meal? We need to invite them over to our home. I need to tell my story to them. I need to humble myself and tell them where I struggle and what my journey has been so that they have safe territory on which they can ask questions and try to find the hope for their marriage or for faith in Christ as the ultimate solution to their life. The solution to the blitz, and I'll try to take this football analogy and make it work. Number one, it begins with expecting the blitz. It's going to come. Number two is vision. You need to have a long-term vision that sees problems as opportunities for God to work. The verse that I love to turn to is Romans 5, 3-5. And amazingly, on the airplane, as I was getting ready to prepare this message on the plane, you know, I'm a procrastinator and everything kind of comes together at the last minute for me. It's kind of like two-minute offense. That's my favorite time of the game. So as I was getting ready to kind of prepare a bit and hone, I sat down next to a Buddhist monk. And I thought, this might lead to a conversation. I may not get to prepare as much. But God took care of everything. And we had an amazing conversation. Turned out he's in a blitz. He's questioning his disciplines. They're not working for him. All the meditation he's practiced for 13 years isn't eliminating the anxiety that he's facing. He can't gain healing to some of the physical ailments. The community, when he failed to perform as they wanted him to, didn't feel like a community that accepted him in the same way. And so he's going through a crisis. I wouldn't call it faith because it really isn't a faith. It's more of a process that they pour themselves into, seeking ultimate happiness, crushing away the imperfections of life. I have a whole napkin full of what Buddhist principles are as I asked him to explain it to me. And a lot of it lines up with Christian principles of wisdom that we get from the Bible. They're fabulous principles. And that's all these Ten Commandments and all these edifying words, et cetera, et cetera. But what I didn't see anywhere in it is a relationship. And what I didn't see anywhere in it is this love that you receive because you've done nothing to deserve it. And then in a moment like he's in, that there's something that you can rest upon that says, you are good, you are loved, there's an answer. I'll wrap my arms around you regardless of what you do. And amazingly, after telling a blitz story and how I got kicked out of football and what my bad chapter was, kind of in parallel to his, I was able to read Romans 5, 3-5 with him. And it says that we also, besides the fact that we are justified by faith in Jesus Christ, the work that he's done that we couldn't do for ourselves, which gives us eternal life and a whole new meaning. That's a pretty awesome thing to rejoice in. But it says, in addition to that, we rejoice in what? Our sufferings? Our sufferings. We rejoice in our sufferings because suffering brings about perseverance. Perseverance brings about character. Character is what Romans 8:29 talks about, being conformed to the image of Jesus Christ, the character, the personality, the traits of Christ. Suffering, perseverance, character, and character produces hope, which is the thing this world is dying for. And hope doesn't disappoint us because the love of God has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit. And Gary Smalley lives his life based on this principle, and I really got excited about this principle by talking to Gary, who went through a life blitz, a real challenge, a questioning time in his soul where all the success of the world led to emptiness in his spirit. And he came back to the core truths of humility before God, loving God, loving others, And his final fourth principle that he lives his life on is gratitude and a positive outlook toward trials, tribulations, suffering, and problems. Why? Because those are the times where you're not taking satisfaction in the nice new car you're driving down the road, or the enjoyable vacation you're enjoying, or the super return you had on your investment, or your kid hitting the home run to win the game, or getting an A, or any of the other stuff that makes us happy, or running a good conference, doing kingdom work. Is it satisfaction in those achievements that brings us much, much closer to Jesus? Or is it the times where the pieces aren't put together and the things are struggling and we are suffering, and where do we have to turn for ultimate solace, love, and comfort? To God. And all of a sudden when we do that, we feel even more love than we felt before. So it's in suffering where we receive love that the world's circumstances can't bring us. So the Blitz calls for knowing they're coming, having a vision that's long-term and values trials and challenges and blitzes and sees the danger as opportunity in the same moment. And then going back to the basics. And we're learning many basics here. Many fundamentals. Love others before yourself. Live based on faith, not on sight. But the basics are treat others the way you want to be treated. And that makes sense in the Bible. And it makes sense in your marriage. So go back to the basics. Vince Lombardi told his team one time after they played a really bad game, brought him back out to the practice field the next day in the summer training camp, and instead of giving him a conversation about zone defense or blocking assignments, he held up a football. He said, "Gentlemen, this is a football." Legend has it that some lineman said, "Coach, slow down." Might have been a quarterback who said that. Linemen are really the brightest guys on the team. They're amazing. But he was going back to the basics. We must block, we must tackle, we must work as a team. So that's a key to facing blitzes. Back to the basics. And then next is relationships. And I think this is the ultimate answer to blitzes. You turn to vertical relationships with God when the trial is hitting you and say, "I need a source different than myself. I'm being reminded right now that I am not a little one-man superstar show. I can't handle life on my own. I need you. You're teaching me something. I'm going to tap into you. I want the big picture, and I want your purpose, not my own." That's a good thing that trials bring us because we're imperfect sinners. But the other great thing is to seek horizontal relationships. God intended us for relationship and for teamwork and for reaching out. And he does his work through us to touch other lives. And relationships are the ligaments that connect us to one another. So when the blitz hits, you realize, shoot, I was so focused on getting this done and this done and this done and making this profit and going to that city and et cetera, that I was not quite paying attention to the heart connection between two people, the communication style that I have with my wife, the loyalty that I show to my kids. So turning to horizontal relationships and vertical relationships is really the answer to the blitz. And in football, you know, a quarterback, you know, probably if he's a Christian, he's going to pray, "God, help me get the ball off before I'm killed." But he then is going to turn to his receivers and hope they make the right adjustment really quickly. And then some running back dives in front of the blitzing safety. But you need each other. You can't pull it off. Someone asked me to mention the word in the outline, Ubuntu, a Swahili word. And what it means is, I am because we are. I am. My very existence is based in the fact that we are. And Ephesians 2:10, the passage says, "Well, for we are God's workmanship." I think the Greek is poema, which sounds like poem, poetry, masterpiece, something special that God has handcrafted for a great purpose. But it doesn't say that you, individual, solo, are the masterpiece. You, as part of the team, the body, in relationship to others, are the masterpiece. We, this group, is a masterpiece. I guess we are a masterpiece. But we're one. That's Ephesians 2:10's concept of Ubuntu. I am because we are. And I am because he is, and he made us as a we. So you got to keep that in mind when you face the blitzes and say, what can I learn more about teamwork than I was living up to this point? John 17 is Jesus' prayer for us, where his focus is that we would know the full measure of his joy. And then what does he pray for? Oneness and complete unity. Which tells us when you net it all out in life, the teamwork, family, the bond of marriage, and unity amongst the body of Christ, the importance of relationships, pretty much trumps most everything else, and then you build other stuff on top of those. The principle of subsidiarity takes you right back to relationships with God vertically, with people horizontally, and marriage is the central one. And I'm saying in this message that your marriage is not a solo entity either. It is a team of teams. you need friends. Lakita and Jeff's marriage is a friend to Jeff and Stacy's marriage. And my marriage is a friend to Lakita and Jeff's. And when her little boy gets married, he's going to have help from Dennis and Jan, who will be friends of that young boy's marriage. And the message she might struggle to get across to her own son, because he kind of wants to do it his own way, Jan is going to have an amazing chance to pull this guy aside someday and remind him or help his wife-to-be. And we all play those roles for one another. That's a team of teams, friends for marriage. Here's a picture of teamwork as we talk about a movement. You want to run a business? You want to build a school? You want to advance a missionary outpost in another country? You want to fuel a strengthening effort for marriages in your own church, community, region, state, nation? Then teamwork is going to be necessary, because no one can do anything by themselves. Bill Walsh was the best teacher and coach I've ever had in my life, the coach of the San Francisco 49ers who passed away about 4 years ago. And Bill used to call us in to teach the plays, and instead of having the quarterbacks in one room and the receivers in another room and the linemen in another room and splitting us all up and having us be taught our specific solo jobs, he brought us all together first to teach the whole vision. Then they let the guys break up into their specific positions. He wanted us to have the whole vision. And Bill didn't start when he was teaching Brown Wright fake 22Z post. He didn't start with the mechanics of the play. He started with, remember why we're here, guys. We're here to be a team that wins Super Bowls year after year after year and is the best team in the league for the decade. We need to be so excellent every day in practice and improving every day on the practice field and in the games that we're on the way to becoming a Super Bowl champion. So if you win by 30 points but you haven't played your best and we haven't improved that week, I'm not happy. And if we lose a game but we've improved, I'm not happy but I'm proud. I'm pleased that you're making progress. I don't like to lose, but I can find much value in the fact that you improved today, because I think that tells me that eventually we can be winning games at the end of the season and win a Super Bowl. He laid out the big vision, the big picture. Do you train people in abstinence, as Lakita has for many, many, many years, and some of the rest of us have? Do you talk to your kids about sex and abstinence and all that stuff? Well, if you do it well, as she has, you paint a much bigger picture than this little teeny tactic. You give them the yes, not just the no's. And you talk about the consequences for the long term and the beauty of having reserved the most special gift you can give to your spouse-to-be and the forgiveness of accepting forgiveness if you've been off track and starting a secondary path of virginity, saving your sexual gift for your spouse, because there's grace and God can turn the corner. And you paint a long-term picture of that. So Walsh tells us our goal, the Super Bowl. Then he says, okay, Brown right, fake 22, Z post. Let's get into it. On this play, I want the lineman to dive left, cut blocking, just like they would on a running play. And then I'd like for the quarterback, turn your back to the defensive line, stick the ball in the stomach of Roger Craig, the halfback, as he goes by you. I want the wide receivers, Jerry Rice, you've been blocking tough all game long, hitting that on every play, whether he's on your side of the field or not. Go down and stalk him, get ready to hit him. He thinks it's a running play because you're in a low position, crouching to block again. And then quarterback, after you stick the ball in, pull it back into your stomach and hide it while your left hand does a little matador move and follows Roger's gut right into the line of scrimmage. And Roger, you're not going to get any yards on the stat sheet for this play. You're not going to get to break a touchdown. You're going to have an imaginary football in your hands. You've got to wrap up like it's in your gut. And then I want you to run to that hole full speed, pell-mell, convincing the defense you got the ball. And that means they're going to hit you. And even if the line is crowded, dive over the line of scrimmage, and they're going to smack you in the head. Don't put your hands up to protect yourself. They'll know you don't have the ball. You got to convince them you got the ball. Lyman, you're going to get your finger stepped on, your head's going to get kneed, but it's going to look like a cut block, which is a running play, and they'll think that we're running. And quarterback, you better do that fake well. And then when you come out of it at about 1.8 seconds and you look down the field, find that free safety. Because with Jerry Rice stock blocking and all the linemen cutting and Roger Craig diving in the line of scrimmage and you're back to the safety for those few minutes with that little matador move, he will have taken two steps forward. And if he does, that's enough to get a little bit of a gap on him. And Jerry Rice, just as the cornerback settles, you break inside of him, go to the deep post, run as fast as you can on a post route. And then quarterback, get rid of the ball about 1.8 seconds because at about 2.5, the defensive end on this side of the field, who we do not block on running plays, will be free, will wake up, realize it's not a run, and he'll hit you. And you'll be on the ground when you figure out whether or not this is a success or a failure. But if we've all done our part, it should be a touchdown. And does that sound like it's worth it? It getting toward a Super Bowl to be the best team of the decade? Does that sound like great teaching? Can you think of the things in your life where you could explain a little bit more of the big picture, the passion? And there's some cool principles to it. I put down four of them. Number one is common vision. This is great teaching of teamwork. Number two is relational trust. You trust one another because you've been around each other and you know each person's been trained very well. Thirdly, it's respect for roles. In theology, it would be called respect for dominion. Each of you have a unique dominion that God's put in you where you have an influence and a ministry that's greater than what I have. And you might say, oh, Jeff does that well. Well, that might be my dominion. And you can celebrate that I'm doing my thing while I can celebrate that you're doing your thing. And we're all part of the same team, so we can all say, praise God, he wins the Super Bowl at the end of the season. And it's okay that you're a receiver and I'm a quarterback. But a lot of us don't want to respect roles. We have to think, oh, the quarterback, he gets more praise and credit. That's not right. Or my role is just not valued or important enough. No, every role is vital. And they all come together. And when there's little concern for who gets the credit, much can be accomplished. That was the little sign on Ronald Reagan's desk. I'm sure many others have used that phrase over the years. Common vision, relational trust, respect for roles, which would take us to the book of Ephesians and the book of Genesis, and I think 1 Peter, that give us great biblical blueprints for how marriage is intended to work, with a husband and wife understanding their dominion and their roles, working together, leadership and headship helping, both equal, yet with roles that complement, so that you can be the very best missionary couple into the culture and parents to your kids. And with the roles working and the respect, then that marriage can stay together. When it's two people competing, it's not going to work. And finally, if you have all those things, common vision, relational trust, respect for the roles, what are couples going to do? They're going to sacrifice. They're going to generously sacrifice. The linemen will dive on the ground and get their head kicked in. Their hands are bleeding all season long. Roger Craig will dive over the line of scrimmage and get smashed for no yards on the stat sheet because he'd like his team to win, because he trusts that the credit will go to the whole team and the other guys will do their part. It's a great picture for marriage, and it's a great picture for a business or a school or a team or any entity, a church, that wants to accomplish God's great goals for them. Here's a quick view from a quarterback standpoint of a champion at building teams, Nehemiah. Nehemiah faced a blitz. They'd gotten their eyes off of God. They'd been distracted, and the consequences came upon them, and they got trashed, and the walls got broken down in Jerusalem. And Nehemiah, I'll speed through this, started with a broken heart. God has a broken heart. He doesn't have a punishing, angry heart toward us. He has a broken heart. And broken hearts can win over anyone because they have compassion. And then out of his compassion, Nehemiah was humble enough to get down on his knees and pray. And did he confess the sins of the nation alone? Or did he start with his own? He was a really holy dude. Nehemiah was a stud on the righteousness scale. But he knew he wasn't perfect and he had his own sin. And it always starts right there. And if you ever want someone to confess their sin, the best thing you can do is confess yours to them. And then not expect anything from them. And maybe the Holy Spirit will be the conscience. Because you are never the conscience for someone else. You can just demonstrate that you let the Spirit work on you. And that puts someone else at a spot where, oh, I have some things to apologize to. Which brings us to husbanding. Because men are responsible for the marriage. And if we really, really, really took leadership responsibly and understood what it meant, he who apologizes first has the leadership opportunity to heal the relationship. He who prays and goes to the Lord has the opportunity to heal the relationship. If men would run to God, would develop their spiritual walk, would admit that they're weak and struggling, and go to other men and say, help me be a good husband, and then eventually apologize to your wife and say, I'm going to work on this. I'm not holding out that you got to do A, B, C, D, and E, F. I'm going to focus on me. A woman is what? A responder. And the marriage will turn around. That doesn't mean women can't lead. They're phenomenal as well. My wife is a killer leader. She has to work to hold her leadership back to allow me to play my role. And when she does that, it pleases God and it pleases me and things come together. And then usually I say, you're so good in this area, go ahead and lead. Oh, you're so good here, lead here. Broken hearts, humility, confessionary prayer, and then what Nehemiah got when he confessed things and was broken before God, he got a vision by going to God. Didn't drum it up on his own. And God gave him a vision. Hey, rebuild the walls and here's the way to do it. And he said, okay, God, I need some help. Give me some lumber. And make sure the other leaders around here don't hurt us while we try to cross the borders bringing this stuff in. And so we got favor in the eyes of leaders of other nations. And so we prayed for favor, as we should, with the mayor or the corporate executive or the media. And he got favor with leadership. And then he built teams of teams that respected the dominion of one another, and they collaborated. Every person working in front of their own home with their family, taking their part in the wall, and said, if any of us struggle, we'll blow the horn and everyone will rally to you. So he went down to the local subsidiarity of each family in front of their own part of the wall. But if we need special help, we'll blow the horn and we'll come join you and help. We're a team. What a model of leadership. The blueprints for marriage and love tie much back to this concept of generosity. Diane Sawyer, the news journalist, she had a great phrase that she used to describe marriage. She said, marriage is a contest of generosity. Just let that sink in. A contest of generosity. Who can initiate more generous, forgiving, loving, gracious, choosing acts toward the other? And when that happens, there's no shortage. It spills over to bless other marriages. It spills over to bless your kids. The rabbis tell a story of two brothers who were farmers. One was married with many children, one was single with no children. And every day they work the fields, work in common, reap the product, take it and put it in two silos, one for the married guy and one for the single brother. And then interestingly, at night, the single brother was concerned for his married brother with all those kids that he had to feed, and it didn't seem quite right that he had the same amount of grain as his brother who had so much. So he would secretly take some of his grain at night and go in the dark and put it in the silo of his brother. And interestingly, his brother thought, my poor brother, he doesn't really have a wife or children to take care of him when he's old. And so I think I should help him out a little bit. So he was taking grain and sneaking around in the dark and putting it in his brother's silo out of concern and compassion and generosity. And they had a secret contest of generosity going on because their hearts were pure. And one night they met each other because they did it at the exact same time. Then the rabbis tell the story that this place was a holy place because generosity had proven love for one another. And it became the holy place on which they built a temple. That really ought to be what our marriages are like. I'm not waiting for her to forgive. I'm forgiving. Because I'm doing it as unto God. And vice versa. Meeting one another's needs regardless. There's a wonderful Jewish marriage expert by the name of Michelle Wiener Davis. Has a ministry called Divorce Busters. And she believes that one person can change a marriage by changing themselves. And if what you've been doing isn't working, begging your husband to come back, change what you're doing. Don't go have an affair. Don't go do something dumb. But get healthy yourself. Take care of yourself. Draw a couple natural boundaries. And say, I'm standing here. I'm not leaving the marriage. I'm committed. I'm going to be responsible. And I'm just going to be a healthy person, as painful as this is. And that husband might start to realize, you know what? I've been taking her for granted. And he may change his behavior because she's changed hers. Now, if he's truly a man of ill will, he might just run away. But she was committed to the relationship. She just changed something. And frequently, we keep doing more of the exact same thing out of our desperation and blindness that creates the very problem we're in, and it makes it worse. I know Dr. Dobson would agree with that in his idea of tough love and the books that he's written. So marriage is a contest of generosity, and I want to go through a few things of what really works in marriage before I wrap up. Number one, lifetime commitment, the attitude you have and the covenant choice you make makes a difference, which is why we really, really need to reteach this. That marriage isn't just a date that you hope will work for a while. And it isn't just an economic arrangement. University of Chicago research showed that 5,000 couples they studied, those that were deeply unhappy and chose to divorce to avoid the unhappiness they were in, which is a typical counseling solution these days, 5 years later, 2/3 were deeply unhappy still. And I promise you that those who maybe were happy, there were some other people around them, like their kids, who weren't very happy. Those who stayed together when they were deeply unhappy for 5 years, they tested them 5 years later, and nearly 80% were happy or very happy. What happened? Perseverance produces character. Character produces hope. Hope doesn't disappoint, and love can be revived. Frankly, by persevering and having a view that we will never divorce and we won't utter that word D, we'll keep it out of our vocabulary, it necessitates personal change to heal the marriage. You better go get some help. You better ask for a mentor. You better join a small group. You better get into the Bible. You better get rid of the addiction that's blowing your marriage out of the water. You better go to a class or a seminar and learn God's blueprints. Maybe go to an intensive. The next great thing that works for marriage, and these are all backed up by research, is marital preparation, not cohabitation and practicing ahead of time in the sexual area. Marital preparation lowers the risk of divorce, and so many couples don't get it. Only about 35% of couples get marriage preparation. Churches marry 80% of the people. Pastors do. So they've got pretty much a monopoly over all those couples. They could say, you know what, you won't get married unless you get full marriage preparation from us. Every church in the community is agreeing to the same high standards. We'll do it our own way, but you're going to get marriage preparation, a premarital inventory. We have mentor couples, small groups and classes. We want to check in with you a year from now. That's a part of the marriage movement that's working. In Clackamas, Oregon, a couple named Tom and Liz Dressel, recovering from his alcoholism that was ruining their marriage, got healed in God, got rid of the alcohol, realized he'd been missing his relationship with his wife, rebuilt it, got smart in all the relationship skills of communication, conflict resolution, handling your money, being a team, not holding it over her, praying together, worshiping together, all of the skills they started getting so excited about, and they learned this thing about churches that work together to prepare couples. And so they, on their own, brought together 150 clergy who signed an agreement in the community of Clackamas that they will marry no couple before their time. Julio and Ernest Gallo. We will sell no wine before its time. We will marry no couple before they are prepared. Divorce rate, down 21% in Clackamas, Oregon in 10 years. A one couple with a transformed marriage and a heart for their community who understood that the church is the most powerful dynamic to change the world. Sexual exclusivity is the number one key to great sex. It's a great way to ask a question. Hey, you know what the number one key to great sex is? You got everyone's attention? It's sexual exclusivity. It means channel all your energies into that one relationship in person. And if there's problems there, don't go dissipate and look for an outside. Get to the root of the problems. Get some help on the relationship, which will open up the spirits, which then takes care of the sexual side. Not to mention, in many cases, there is damage from abuse and addictions and those things. And if you're not going outside the marriage and you're staying focused just on that one relationship, and then you find problems in that area, then you can go seek the professional help, the spiritual help, that can address that and be a healer, not a complainer. Americans are consumers. We complain when it's not going the way we want, and we go somewhere else to get what we need. Sexual exclusivity works. Skill training. Getting trained in the skills of marriage makes a huge difference. And that's why a large number of marriage therapists and counselors today have stopped counseling and they started teaching classes and small groups and teaching skills to couples, because they can do that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday instead of just coming to a meeting every other Thursday and then behaving badly in those 2 weeks in between and not really seeing a turnaround and eventually saying, you know, I wanted you to fix our marriage. Really what they're saying is, I wanted you to fix him. Or I wanted you to fix her. Because you go to that as a consumer. If you go to skill training, you should go saying, I want to change my skills on knowing how to love my wife, knowing how to respect my husband, knowing how to use conflict as an opportunity for intimacy. Because conflict exposes our differences, makes us communicate, realize we're different. I'm never going to become a woman. And she's never going to become a man. And she's never going to get disorganized. And I'm never going to get organized. And we just got to learn to chuckle with it and live with it. And work as a team to complement one another. And the skills make a huge difference. And that's where the marriage strengthening movement is putting a huge emphasis. And also support systems. This makes sense. You can't do anything alone. And Jesus set up a model of discipleship. He didn't just say, go make converts. He said, make disciples. And disciples are made through relationship. Minute to minute hanging out with each other. You know, it used to be that daddies had their sons in the fields or in the foundry with them. And they got mentored along in life and learned life lessons shoulder to shoulder. And women talked about relationships and taught their daughters how to run a household and how to treat the husband and how to care for the kids and how to reach out to the needy in the community. It was done together, and it was discipleship. And so in marriage, doesn't it make sense that if you join a group of other couples that are committed to one another's marriage, that you'd do better? Well, guess what the research is? Gary Smalley said that those couples who join a small group have a 50% lower chance of divorce and a 73% increase in their marital success satisfaction in that first year. But it makes sense, because you're with other people. You're supported, you're accountable, you're part of a team. You're not just going to run off and go have an affair. It can happen in some of the very anomalistic cases, but it's much less likely. You need a support system. That's the basis of life. You need a team. It's so biblical, and it works. So the versions of that are small groups, mentoring, And every one of us has a story, and every one of us has the opportunity to invite someone to our house. Therefore, you're ready to be a mentor. Or take them out to lunch. Sit with them at breakfast. We can mentor others. Tell them our story and guide them to a few resources. If you don't feel like an expert, you just guide them to resources. That's what Stacy and I did. On our team, we were still not, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Perfect. We just knew Gary Smalley's teaching was great, and we kept showing it to couples on our team, and pretty soon we had a marriage ministry. Then we did it in our neighborhood and had a marriage ministry in our neighborhood. And then our pastor said, hey, would you lead the young marriage class? And we said, why? And they said, because if you can make it, anyone can. Great ringing endorsement. But we did lead the young marriage class at church, and we were very transparent and threw our junk out on the table, and they're like, phew, these problems we're facing are not the only ones in the world to face. This stuff's common. And then we pointed them to good resources. We didn't have all the answers, but we had encouragement and fellowship, and that's what support systems are about. If you know couples who are separation or divorce papers in hand, deep problems, you can go to them and say, I can't imagine the pain, and I don't know all the issues, but I can tell you there is hope. And there are examples of couples in situations like yours that have made it. Can I introduce you to the intensive program at the Windshape Retreat Center in Atlanta that Lakita and I have been to, where they have a 91% success rate of couples coming from brokenness getting healed and happy 2 years later when they measure them. There are intensives like this around the country. They cost some money, but much better to spend $3,000 over 4 days than $3,000 over 2 years and not stay together. And then I'll mention prayer, because I've not heard the specific proven research, but I have people come up to me all the time with crazy stats, like 1 in 1,000 couples that prays together every day, divorces. I don't know what the stats are. I do know that prayer leads to humility, and humility leads to intimacy, and intimacy with each other is what she's looking for and what lets him have her respond to him, which is what he's looking for, and which invites God into the relationship so you have something glue that's stronger than crazy glue. So praying together makes sense. And is it awkward? Yeah, because Satan doesn't want you to, and we have different personalities and we do it differently. So just practice and try it and do a little bit and then a little more and a little more and pray together. Well, let me paint this picture. The marriage strengthening movement that a number of us have been a part of has brought a collaboration of groups together for a number of years where we said it's not our group that wants to win, it's the movement that wants to win. I celebrate every other group's success. And we decided that there is a demand problem in our country where people don't know that they actually, that yearning in their heart to make their marriage work, they don't know you can actually get some help to make it work. So we haven't seen demand crystallize in the public's mind yet for getting marriage strengthening education and help. Secondly, we've got a distribution problem. There's a bunch of grassroots, mom-and-pop, cottage industry marriage strengthening groups, and they got the right curriculum. There's a ton of great stuff. It's been developed over 4 years. It changes lives, but it's not yet distributed out there into the marketplace aggressively. So we get these challenges. So we don't really have a supply or a solution problem. We get this distribution, this demand problem. So what we want to do is build a platform using social media and the entertainment field at a website called loveishere.com. That tells stories of hope, because Jesus told stories, and hope is what people need if they want to turn to the help. So we tell stories of hope that come from real people, authentic stories, and then hope points you to get the help. And you press a button and get to your zip code, and you find out the conferences, classes, seminars, retreats that work. Plus, we've aggregated a bunch of the best content from all these marriage experts up on our site, and it's really not like we're the experts. We're saying the experts are the experts, and you can find them here. It's like the all-star team of marriage strengthening. And then after that, if you're really gung-ho and you want to help others, you're a marriage champion, and we'll give you ideas on how to help others and spread a movement. Mentoring, small groups, start a marriage ministry in your church, get something going in your business, do it through schools. So the website, loveishere.com, it's kind of like YouTube with a conscience and a purpose. Purpose is fuel positive stories of hope for marriage and lifelong love. We got a branding problem as well, which is why it's called Love is Here, not Marriage is Here. You get about 10 times more people to go to Love is Here than Marriage is Here. And what is marriage? It's love. It's the most generous version of love possible, with commitment and covenant, and it's not just about two people in a consumer relationship. It's a bigger institution that's about others and about a legacy. So there's YouTube, and then you drive people to help, which is like the United Way meets Yellow Pages meets MapQuest. And you drive people back to all the help they need in the local community. And then you encourage folks, hey, be a helper to others. Be a team for marriage. That's our goal. So go to loveishere.com, and we want to make a way that we can serve all the local marriage initiatives around the country. If a church is doing something, if a community is doing something, we celebrate their success as part of the big team. So I wrap up by saying that your marriage or your status as a single person related to relationships and your yearning for marriage, your marriage is a spiritual barometer of your life. And if it's struggling, just take it as kind of like a little canary in the coal mine and say, "Oh, there's not enough spiritual love oxygen here. I need to run back to God and straighten out my relationship with Him." So it's a barometer on your spiritual life. And if you're a single person dying to get married, just dying to get married, and it's holding you back from everything else that God has for you, it's a spiritual barometer that Jesus in my relationship with is enough. Maybe you've been given the gift of singleness, which is a fabulous gift. Well, you don't have to take care of a wife all the time. You can just go out and do the Lord's work. But of course, that's a minority, because without marriage, you won't have a procreative, regenerating society. Okay, and then other marriages, you can view other people's marriages or their status, if they're trying to be married or if they're living together, you can view that as a pipeline to their soul. Do you want to really touch people? Talk about relationships. It's a pipeline to their soul. And many times it's a more effective evangelistic outreach than many other things that we try. So I don't have any Super Bowl rings on my hands, but I have this ring. And the next time you see a ring, every time you see a ring, make the thought, what am I doing to strengthen my personal conviction, my personal practice, my personal submission to God of following and honoring His blueprints for marriage? And every time you see a child, don't just think, oh yeah, what's that kid up to? Think, what's marriage going to be like for that child someday? And am I doing things today to make sure that the next generation of marriages has a chance for hope and health and a society that's anchored on that principal relationship that we can't live without? Thanks. God bless.
This is a copyrighted program of Strategic Christian Services, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Strategic Christian Services offers a wide variety of other educational materials and training schools designed to help you live life to its fullest. For more information on our products and services, please call us at 1-800-700-0605. Join us online at www.gostrategic.org or write to us at Post Office Box 2709, Santa Rosa, California, 95405.